This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Jeremiah Jacques, contributing editor for the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. I'm filling in today for your regular host, Mr. Joel Hilliker. We really appreciate you joining us on Trumpet Hour today, and our panel of trumpet writers have some momentous stories that they're anxious to tell you all about. Here in the studio in Edmond, Oklahoma, we have Andrew Miller.
Good to be here.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Israel, we have Brent Noctegal.
Hello.
And joining us via Skype from our office in the UK is Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And also in the UK is Kieran Underwood.
Hello.
Well, the Trumpet devotes no small amount of attention and time to watching the Islamic Republic of Iran. We've carefully watched over the years as Iran has worked to reshape the Middle East and just to dominate that region. We've watched and reported as Iran has repeatedly threatened Israel, which it calls the Little Satan, and as it's become increasingly aggressive against the United States, which it calls the Great Satan. But this week, Iran has threatened a new power in a way that we've not really heard before. And to tell us about this, we'll go to our man in the Middle East, Brent.
Yeah, this was quite a bold bit of rhetoric from the Iranians, specifically from a Brigadier General Hossein Salami. And he was speaking in response to what the French president, the French foreign ministry have been saying about Iran over the past, I would say, 3 weeks. The French have been more bold towards the Iranians, basically saying what's been quite obvious to us and many, especially here in Israel, about what Iran desires for the Middle East, how they don't, they aren't a peaceful, at least the leadership of Iran, they're not a peaceful player. They are a destabilizing actor. They do intend to take over nations. They do want to threaten other people. And so the French have been standing up to this, at least rhetorically, and saying, at least this week, speaking against the ballistic missile program, twice in the past week, the French government has come out, the French president even today, talking about how Iran, if I would just quote Macron earlier today, he called for uncompromising dialogue with Tehran over its missile program, and that he wanted Iran to have a less aggressive strategy in the region. And the Iranians didn't like that. But going back to what happened earlier this week, what happened was, in response to comments like that, this brigadier general basically said that we hadn't considered Europe a threat in the region, and we hadn't sought to expand our missile capabilities to hit Western Europe. But if Europe decides that it wants to threaten us and our program, our military ballistic missile program, then we might just increase our ballistic missiles so that they can reach them.
So they're talking about expanding the range of their ICBMs so that Europe would be within range of those missiles.
Right. Well, right now they can reach Eastern Europe with what they have, up to about 2,000 kilometers. And even the Ayatollah has put a cap on the development of anything further than that. He's said that because he felt like they had no reason to do that. Many American bases within that distance, so they thought that they could target the Americans, they could target the Israelis already, and they could target Eastern Europe. And what Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has been saying for so long about Iran's ballistic missile program to the rest of the world is, hey, I'm not saying this for me. I'm not saying this for Israel. Israel can already get hit by anything from Iran. I'm right. Saying it for you in Western Europe mainly, because what Iran is developing, it's aimed at people or nations outside that 2,000-kilometer range. And what this Iranian general said is accurate. If Europe does want to threaten us, or at least what they see as a threat, then we're going to return with our bigger threats.
What can you tell us about where the Iranian-European relationship is right now?
Well, it's very interesting because you have the European Foreign Ministry or the EU, basically, and they're trying to still downplay this spat between the French and the Iranians. A lot of European nations, including France, are heavily invested in Iran in the post-nuclear deal world, especially the Germans and the French. And so they do have to – Europe has to make this decision whether it wants to jeopardize the economic gain that it has received and wants to further receive, having access to Iran's 80 million people ever since a lot of these sanctions have come down. And yet what we're seeing is, well, Iran is basically being a very unsavory actor who is pushing the rest of the Middle East into chaos. And so do we break off those deals? Or at least hinder those or put those deals in jeopardy by going after Iran with more sanctions or even potentially some type of stoppage militarily. Europe hasn't said they want to do that, but going after Iran's ballistic missile program, saying we're going to sanction you if you don't stop that. Iran specifically kept the ballistic missile program out of the nuclear deal to ensure that they could continue to do that. Mm-hmm. Well, now the French are saying, no, you can't have free access to those technologies.
Could you please put this development in the context of Bible prophecy for us?
Yeah, if we're going to look at this in terms of biblical prophecy, it's really important that our listeners understand that we are watching for a Middle Eastern power bloc, which is known in biblical terminology as the King of the South. And we've labeled that since 1993, our editor-in-chief has, as radical Islam led by Iran. And that King of the South has a pushy foreign policy, as Daniel chapter 11 and verse 40 talks about, and it pushes at another king, the King of the North, which is European nations led by Germany. And so what we're seeing right now is an Iranian threat of firing or developing ballistic missile technology to target Europeans specifically. That is a push that the King of the North or this European superpower eventually will react against. That's what your Bible says. And so we're watching any type of reaction, any type of action from the Iranians, because up to this point, they haven't done it. Up to this point, the Europeans have been their friends. It's been the United States that's tried to come on hard against Iran. But it looks like some in Europe might be changing their tune towards Iran, and therefore Iran is going to start pushing at Europeans.
Wow. So this is it looks like this is really directly kind of setting the stage for the fulfillment of that Daniel 11:40 push by the King of the South against the King of the North. That is really interesting. What literature would you recommend to any listeners who would like to better understand Iran's role as the King of the South and how that fits into Bible prophecy?
Well, I would start with this article we have up this week, written by Anthony Chibariwe. He wrote an article entitled Iran Threatens Europe with Missiles, and it gives you a lot of context. You'll find that on the front page of thetrumpet.com. It's also got some wonderful links to more in-depth material, such as the booklet The King of the South.
Well, thanks very much for that, Brent. Well, while we're on the topic of Europe interacting with Middle Eastern nations, there was another story that broke this week about a different European country, Germany, and its relationship with Iran's regional rival, Saudi Arabia. To talk about this, we'll go to Richard.
That's right. Over the last week or two, we've received a bit more news about Saudi Arabia and its plans to upgrade its arms industry. Because at the moment, Saudi Arabia is a major arms spender. It's currently just behind Russia as the fourth biggest military spender in the world. I think by some counts, it gets pretty close to being on pace with Russia. However, with this massive military spending, only 2% of its military goods are produced inside Saudi Arabia. Hmm. So it's pretty desperate to boost its own domestic arms industry so it can stop relying on other countries and having to import a lot. And that's kind of a big deal for Saudi Arabia right now. It's, you know, the tension between Saudi Arabia and Iran is just all over the news. And so, you know, they need to be able to defend themselves. So one of the main players that they're turning to help them is Germany. They're establishing a Saudi Arabia military industries. And they've gone and poached a top German military executive or executive of one of these military producers to run it. They'll be transferring over from Rheinmetall to take part of this conglomerate. The Saudi Minister of Economic Affairs, this is something that goes back for a few months, but he said last April, German companies have always been here. Many of them have close connections to Saudi Arabia. We want to expand that. The German mentality, which is world famous, has many fans. Everyone would like to be like Germany, and so we would like to learn a lot from Germany. So that is something that they mentioned just in general economically. But they also want the same thing militarily. And Germany's military, they are, I think currently they stand about the fourth biggest arms exporter in the world. For a while there, they were the third biggest arms exporter. And they're a relatively small country when you consider they're playing in the same kind of league as nations like Russia and France as well as another major one. And that's gained a lot of respect from around the world. So when nations like Saudi Arabia want to do a better job in their military spending, they're turning to Germany to help. And this isn't, Saudi Arabia's not the only one doing this. I had an article in the Trumpet Print a month or two back talking about how Turkey is taking the same approach. And you had an article in Handelsblatt that was the headline was something along the lines of Turkish military made in Germany. So you're seeing, and that was the same companies involved, Rheinmetall and then some other German military companies. Mm-hmm. So you're seeing Germany now not just exporting arms to a lot of these Middle Eastern nations, but building the domestic arms industries of these Middle Eastern nations, helping them produce their own weapons, often on German designs and with Germany helping along the way there.
So you mentioned some recent corollaries to this with Germany and some other nations. What about historically? Is there any precedent for this development?
Yeah, this is really a return to Germany's traditional role, especially during, say, like the 19th century, where you would quite regularly have German arms exports traveling overseas, helping other people's armies, also helping their domestic military, again, specifically with the Middle East, reaching out to Turkey and helping to modernize the Turkish army as a way of then, you know, developing them that they can use as a close ally in wars in the Middle East. So, yeah, this is absolutely a very traditional role for Germany to be playing. That's one of the reasons why we watch this. Of course, another key reason is, you know, not only is there a lot of historical precedent for this, and even a lot of historic warning about the role that Germany tends to play in this regard, but it's also something, or one of the key prophecies that we watch at thetrumpet.com. It's one of the trends articles that we have in our trends section, because it's one of the, you know, it's one of these most important forecasts that we watch. We've said for several years, we talked about Germany building up an alliance of nations within the Middle East. And you can, there are a number of different prophecies that relate to that. The most direct is in Psalm 83. That talks about an alliance of nations that never existed before in history, which very, you know, that means that it's prophecy for the modern era. And that is about Assyria or modern day Germany allying with a whole host of Middle Eastern powers. That's just one prophecy. There are several others that give more detail as to what we're watching here. And that trends article that we have on the website, it's called Why the Trumpet Watches an Alliance Between Arab Nations and Europe, is a great place to get caught up with just what's going on here and where this growing alliance is leading. And it's we're seeing an acceleration of these type of news stories with Germany getting more and more involved with these countries as these countries become more and more desperate for allies with Iran, turning more and more to Europe. So it's a great place to read up and just watch Bible prophecy unfold and watch the Bible be proved right and just come alive before your eyes.
Yeah, and we'll have a link to that article in the show notes. And we also have an article up on thetrumpet.com right now written by Josue Michel about these deepening Berlin-Riyadh ties. It's called Germany to Upgrade Saudi Arabia's Armaments Industry. So please go to thetrumpet.com and check that out. And we'll also have a link to that in our show notes for today's program. Well, thanks very much for that, Richard. So after about 2 months of hiatus and relative calm, North Korea conducted yet another test this week of an intercontinental ballistic missile. This one flew higher and farther than any previous missile. And to tell us about the story, we'll go to Kieran Underwood.
Yeah, so North Korea finally launched this. It was on a Wednesday. They launched it, and as usual, they launched it over Japan. This particular missile, which is called Hwasong 15, went up 2,800 miles. So that's the highest it's ever been. Way too high for anyone to try and shoot it. Too high for the Americans in South Korea to try and shoot it down. Too high for the Japanese to shoot it down when it's flying right over their country. And this is what the North Koreans call a super large heavy warhead. What that means is it's able to carry something that is very heavy, which is the main facet which can increase or decrease how far it can go. So if you want a missile to reach a certain place, you need to make sure that it can carry a heavy enough warhead. So of course, that super large heavy warhead is designed to carry as much weight as possible. And this one, they say, has finally been able to reach the U.S. mainland.
So Kim Jong-un has been in office now for about 6 years, and this makes his 89th missile test. Is this pace of testing normal for North Korean leaders, or is Kim Jong-un testing more than his father and his other predecessors?
Well, I'm not sure of the exact statistics, but Kim Jong-un has the advantage over his father and his grandfather in that the increase in the technology has been so much greater under his rule of North Korea. The reason this launch is different than all the other ones in the whole scheme of it is that this is the first one that he is able to say will definitely reach the U.S. mainland. It has that amount of scope. And then that leads Kim Jong-un to say on Wednesday that North Korea has finally realized the great history cause of completing the state nuclear force. So he's come out and said, we have reached the goal. We have completed what we've set out to do. We've completed our nuclear program. And of course, he'll probably continue to take more tests, to get missiles that go further and longer. But he said, boom, we have completed our goal. Here's a quote from Jeffrey Lewis. And this Jeffrey Lewis is the director of the East Asian Non-Proliferation Program. And clearly he's upset because he hasn't been able to succeed in his non-proliferation program. But he pretty much says the nuclear program is completed. It's done. And the whole point of a preventative war, he says, is to do it before you would get nuclear weapons. And he says, you're pretty much past this point. Even so, both the South Korean and the American officials say that while they do have a nuclear capability, they won't be able to pair that with their intercontinental ballistic missile until at least 2 to 6 months.
Okay, could you please put these developments in the context of Bible prophecy for us?
Okay, so I want to put this in context of two scriptures that often the trumpet points to. And the first one is one that Mr. Joel Hilliker pointed to in his recent trumpet brief when he talked about this event. He said, he referenced the scripture in Isaiah 33:7. He says, the ambassadors of peace shall weep bitterly. And there's another scripture in Jeremiah 6:14 that says, that's prophesying about the Israelite countries, the United States in particular. It says, they have treated my people's brokenness superficially, claiming peace, peace, when there is no peace. And when a lot of American officials or experts will talk about these developments in their articles or on the news, they often try to downplay it. There's a piece from the National Interest that Mr. Joel Hilliker also quoted. he quotes two experts who both point to this not being as bad as you would think. One says that all we need to do is just have continued economic pressure and pursue diplomatic off-ramps, and then we'd be able to make sure that Pyongyang doesn't ever get to using these weapons. Then another expert, his name's John Citrioni, he says, there is actually hope in this because having a full nuclear capacity will make Kim Jong-un more open to diplomacy. And I think when you look at those types of comments coming from some of the media where they say this is not really as big a problem as you would expect. Yeah, they have a nuclear weapon, but we can continue to use diplomacy. And you pair that with these prophecies saying the ambassadors of peace shall end up weeping bitterly. And then the prophecies that people will say, peace, peace, when there is no peace. And you pair those together with the usual American outlook on these things. Well, we can still use diplomacy. Well, we can still work this out. That's an attitude that was prophesied, and that's an attitude that we're seeing right now.
And what literature would you recommend to any listeners who'd like to better understand how this fits into end-time prophecy?
Well, I think definitely the most recent one and the most powerful one is Mr. Gerald Flory's Nuclear Armageddon is at the Door. And really, there is no other age in history, and this is what Mr. Gerald Flory points out, there's no other age in history where it's been possible to have nuclear war. Only in the last 50 years or so, you've had that dreadful option to pretty much wipe out millions of people.
Thanks very much for that, Kieran. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. And most of the stories that we're discussing today are up on our website, thetrumpet.com, or they will be up there very soon if they're not yet. So please visit thetrumpet.com to get more information on these important stories. We're going to take a break in just a moment, but first we'll cover one more story showing that the age of comparative peace that the world has enjoyed for the last 70 years or so is far more fragile than it may appear. To tell us about this, we'll go to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, there's actually an article I read this week in Foreign Policy by Max Boot. He's a senior fellow for the Council of Foreign Relations, warning that the United States military doesn't actually have enough money to do its job. And we've been talking about threats in Saudi Arabia and threats in North Korea and threats in other nations. And he's making the case that America is very ill-prepared right now to deal with all of these threats. They point out that President Trump has really been pushing for a $50 billion increase to the U.S. military. Yeah. Congress kind of one-upped him on that and authorized up to a $100 billion increase. But the appropriation committees aren't likely to actually increase it much at all, just because Republicans are working for tax cuts and Democrats are working for increased health care and social spending. And it's just coming down to the financial realities that the money's not there for spending much more on the military. And I know some of our listeners may be thinking right now that, like, okay, well, America still spends more than the next seven or eight nations combined. But the big difference you have to realize is America is kind of playing a different game, to where China's priorities are for their military is defend China, number one, and number two, project power into the South China Sea.
Right.
America's priorities are number one, defend America, and number two, unilaterally enforce world peace. And so we did have a article up on our website earlier this week just pointing out the fact that even though China's military budget is only a third of what America's is, it's roughly the same of what America spends defending Asia. So that's actually a pretty shocking statistic that America spends a third of the Pentagon's budget just on Asia and the Pacific, trying to just more or less keep peace in that area.
So in that region, there could be parity really between the U.S. and China.
Right. If they were to actually, I guess, hypothetically have a major conflict between U.S. and China, they are more or less on parity unless the United States just mobilized resources from other parts of the world. But then who's keeping the peace over there?
So this does sound like a really alarming trend. The U.S. is not able to spend as much as it needs to be, and meanwhile, China, Russia, Iran, North Korea, other powers like that that are extremely adversarial toward the U.S. are ramping up their own spending. I wonder if you could describe a specific conflict scenario in which the U.S. could probably be militarily defeated.
As far as like the conflict scenario, like on the U.S. homeland, at least no security experts are talking about that. But the main threat they're talking about is that as America realizes that it can't keep peace in every region of the world and starts pulling back some of these overseas military bases, and they do spend a full quarter of the Pentagon's budget on overseas bases, that you could start seeing conflicts, specific conflicts in like the South China Sea or Crimea, where it's not necessarily a threat to the 50 states, but it is a threat to their 50 states' ability to protect trade routes in other parts of the world.
Could you talk some about the role that innovation plays in defense spending and just why it's so much more expensive for the U.S. to maintain a technological edge than it is for countries like China to just essentially replicate existing technologies and just play catch up with more innovative powers?
Well, it definitely is cheaper to copy technology than to do the original research, which is what a lot of, like you just said, foreign nations do tend to doing. And it's easier to break something than to build it.
Right.
And so you've got the U.S., there's something like the Global Satellite Positioning System, where you're trying to look at technologies that can detect nuclear missiles and shoot them out of the air that are just really advanced. And so some nations that are like China are looking to for victory in like a regional conflict in the South China Sea. They don't have to build an anti-ballistic missile defense shield as advanced to the United States. They just need to find out one small way to make the United States ones not work for a few days.
Right. So all of that research and development and attempts at innovation are incredibly inefficient, which is why it's a big part of the reason why it's so difficult for the U.S. to maintain that leadership role, always being ahead of whatever potential enemies could throw at us.
Right.
Could you talk a little bit about this trend in terms of how it connects to Bible prophecy?
Right. One actually thing I really wanted to point out is I'm working on a Why the Trumpet Watches America Retreat from Global Leadership article that should be on our website in a couple weeks. And there's a good section of that devoted to a very specific prophecy in Micah 5. It's talking about the end time. And it says, in context of the end time, and the remnant of Jacob shall be in the midst of many people as a dew from the Lord, as a shower upon the grass that tarries not for man nor waits for the sons of men. And the remnant of Jacob shall be among the Gentiles in the midst of many people as a lion amongst the beasts of the forest and a young lion amongst flocks of sheep. And basically when you get into this, this is talking that in the end time or just before the end of our age, the nations of Israel are going to be like a lion amongst the nations. That's basically an old-timey Israelite way of saying the world's policeman. You're the king of beast.
Yeah.
And so that's just an amazing proof is that if you've proven, if our listeners have proven that we are nearing the end time, and you want to know which nations on earth are descended from the ancient Israelites, all you need to find is who's the world's policeman.
Wow.
It's basically like who's the Pax Americana itself is proof that the American and the British peoples and the Pax Americana and the Pax Britannica before it are proof that these people are descended from Israel, and which should be concerning, which is getting to the heart of why the trumpet watches this, is in the very next few verses, it talks about because the people turn away from God and embrace witchcraft and soothsayers, which is, again, just another old-timey way of talking about like pagan religious practices or lawlessness or moral relativism, that God will break the pride of their power, cut them off right at the zenith, and actually be like a lion to them. God will be like the lion who's tearing tearing up the previous line.
So the table is turned there.
To turn things around. So that is just something that really gets to the heart of why the trumpet watches this, is that this is a prophecy that in the end time, those nations descended from Israel would be the world superpower. They would be the power keeping peace. They would turn away from God, and because of that, God would take those blessings away. And that's kind of what they're seeing right now, with America realizing that even if it is the world's most powerful military, still it's not quite powerful enough to keep defending both North America and South America and Africa and Asia and Europe simultaneously. And as they pull back from those scenes, other powers are rising to fill that void. And the Bible says those powers will eventually turn against the previous lion as he ages.
Hmm. What literature would you recommend to listeners who'd like to better understand the prophetic significance of Pax Americana and of what we're now seeing, where that's very quickly coming to an end?
Right, and this is probably, I think, the most requested book in of Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong's time was his book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. And so that's the main book that's really going to describe to you all you need to know about the United States and Britain in prophecy. But especially, I guess, if you've read it before and you're just wanting to catch up on what I'm talking about today, especially chapter 14 is the one that talks in detail about all the verses in Micah that I just went through briefly.
Okay, and we'll be sure to have links to the U.S. and Britain and Prophecy in the show notes for today's program. Thanks very much for bringing us up to speed on that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour here on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial. The live stream is available anywhere in the world if you just type kpcg.fm into your internet browser. Coming up, we're going to talk about Europe and China deepening their ties, Egypt's dilemma in dealing with jihadis, Russia and China overtaking the U.S. in a vital field, and a worrying ruling that was just issued for the U.S. military. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
This is Jeremiah Jacques filling in for your regular host, Mr. Joel Hilliker. And a week ago today, on the Muslim Day of Prayer, more than two dozen jihadis carried out the deadliest terrorist attack in modern Egyptian history. This is an appalling tragedy, and it really presents the Egyptian authorities with a difficult dilemma. To tell us about this, we'll go once again to Brent. And Brent, maybe you could start off just telling us about some of the details of the attack itself and what the casualty figures are.
Yeah, so right now I think it stands to be over 300 people dead from this. It was a really sophisticated raid inside this, well, around and inside this mosque in the northern part of the Sinai. And it was, there were numerous explosions or bombs that went off inside the mosque. And then as people were trying to escape, they were mowed down by men on the outside with automatic weaponry. And so this is the deadliest terrorist attack in modern Egyptian history. And it's against Muslims. It's against which a lot of the jihadis would look at as being not necessarily infidels, but they're definitely heretics, Muslim heretics, this version of Islam. Nevertheless, it does present the government of Egypt with a lot of challenges. Egypt has been trying to tamp down the growth of Islamic jihadi powers inside the Sinai. Ever since 2014, basically in the Sinai, there's been a state of emergency declared, military rule. Well, obviously, Egypt's under military rule right now, under Sisi. But it was for the past 3 years, they've tried to stamp out any type of Islamic extremism from this area because it is a huge space, but sparsely populated, a lot of areas where these groups can hide. There is the affiliate of the Islamic State right there acting in the Sinai, which does threaten both Egypt proper and also areas in the Sinai Peninsula, and they've had numerous attacks, even going back to the bombing of that the Russian jetliner that killed over 200 people back in 2015. Mm-hmm. ISIS, or the Egyptian affiliate of that, claimed that attack, and so you've got the Egyptian government that's trying to suppress and stop these terrorist attacks from taking place. But in order to do that, he's got to, Sisi, that is, the president, clamp down on a lot of freedoms again for the people. There's no real freedom of the press right now in Egypt. There's hardly any freedom of assembly. There's a state of emergency that's gone over the entire country, which allows him to do, allows him to have much more power. And yet the people themselves that aren't involved are feeling threatened by these moves as well.
Is it evident who is behind the attack? Has it been claimed by that ISIS affiliate?
I believe they have claimed it, but it's difficult to know for sure whether they were the ones behind it. There are numerous, even Al-Qaeda factions there in the Sinai Peninsula. Egypt has a lot of jihadi groups, mm-hmm. as does next door Libya, that could they would try and infiltrate Egypt as well. So we're not really sure exactly who did it. But what we're looking at and what we're focusing on at the Trumpet, more importantly, isn't necessarily the group that is behind this. It is the destabilizing effect it will have on the Egyptian government. Right now, we have Abdel Fattah el-Sisi in power. He's a strong man. He's an authoritarian, but he has been somewhat successful at preventing the takeover of Egyptian's government by Islamists. That's what happened back in 2011, 2012 through the Arab Spring. Right. We had the Muslim Brotherhood take over the Egyptian government, and eventually Mohamed Morsi, who was Sisi's boss, was gradually overthrown because of his Islamist, not leanings, but completely Islamist way of ruling. He wanted to implement Sharia law, and the military took over. Now, what the worrying situation is that if Sisi tries to stop these terrorist attacks from continuing, he takes away the people's freedoms. He's trying to ensure that Egypt's economy can grow. He's trying to ensure that there is also the Egyptian public feel protected, mm-hmm. and it's very difficult for him to accomplish both. Keep the people happy and stop the jihadis. It's right. extremely hard to do, and there's many articles coming out of Egypt right now talking about how destabilized Sisi's rule is inside Egypt because of these attacks, and also just the growing groundswell of the population getting upset at the lack of economic growth.
So it looks like this could really weaken his grip on power. Could you place that in the context of Bible prophecy?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we've been watching, and our editor-in-chief has talked about this for such a long time, that eventually Egypt is going to turn over to radical Islam. Egypt is going to have a radical Islamist leader like it had back in 2011 and 2012, and therefore Egypt will ally with the king of radical Islam, which is Iran. Which is becoming more and more obvious to everyone throughout the region, especially as the Sunni leadership in Saudi Arabia, they kind of don't condone radical Islam anymore. And so who is going to be the one that you can look to if you're a radical Islamist government? You're going to look to the leadership of Iran. And so what we're watching for is for the situation in Egypt to become so turbulent that it produces an overthrow of this government and a return to power of someone such as the Muslim Brotherhood. And the Bible talks about this again in Daniel chapter 11 and verse 40 to 43.
And we do have we'll have a link in our show notes to The King of the South, written by Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury, and that goes into great detail about the identity of Egypt in Bible prophecy and Iran, and just points to the way that they will eventually be allied. Well, thanks very much for that, Brent. And this week, Mr. Li Keqiang, the Prime Minister of China, made a trip to Europe, and he said that it's time for Europe and China to take the relationship to the next level. To tell us about this, we'll go once again to Richard.
Yes, over the last few weeks, there have been a number of substantial pushes from China. There was this particular meeting that took place between what's called the 16 plus 1, that's 16 nations in Central and Eastern Europe, and then the plus 1 being China. Then there's also been the Belt and Road Initiative meeting in Tbilisi in Georgia, where they had 50 nations. I think they might even be there still right now, gathering to talk about this Chinese infrastructure initiative. So we've seen a lot of big pushes for this massive infrastructure project that China's got. They're planning on spending literally hundreds of billions to improve the trade links between themselves and Europe. And what's especially been in the focus this week is their trade links in Eastern Europe. And I think it's a really interesting subject because, well, firstly, it relates prophetically, and it encapsulates the relationship very well between Europe and China right now. There's a friendliness, and there's also a lot of tension about it as well. And so there have been a lot of commentary pieces about it this week. So China's drawing close to Eastern Europe. Western Europe, on the other hand, is pretty suspicious of this. Mm. Eastern Europe is, it's Germany's backyard. They're very strongly part of Germany's supply chain, part of just the whole German export and import systems. Their trade with Europe is a massive part of their economies, and their trade with China at the moment is a pretty tiny part. Their source of investment at the moment, for example, for Poland, is over 90% from the EU and only 1% from China. So Europe is pretty suspicious about China getting involved here. But at the same time, this is a key part of China's Belt and Road Initiative. Mm. One of the points of contention between the two is a high-speed rail link that they're working on. It's going from Serbia up into Hungary. And the idea is, we've talked before about how China is pouring a huge amount of resources into the Greek port of Piraeus and making that a key hub for their relationship with Europe. And they're building this high-speed rail link to help connect up the ports in Greece so that they can bring goods over into Central Europe much more quickly. So on the one hand, Europe is very excited to see China investing in some of these poorer countries on building this potential for better trade. But on the other, like I said, they're pretty suspicious that China getting involved in their backyard. And you can see both of these tensions reflected in Bible prophecy. One very exciting prophecy about the end times comes from Isaiah 23, and it talks about a mart of nations, a group of nations, and it goes through several specific countries, and we'll have material that we'll link to that can show you exactly who this is. But it's basically talking about a trade relationship between Europe and then China and Japan and some of these Eastern Asian nations. And so Mr. Flurry started talking about that in around 2010, 2011. Since then, this Belt and Road Initiative has just exploded. It's something that wasn't really a big deal at all before then. Now you're seeing a real push from China to reach out to Europe and to build these trade connections to improve their position over there. Jeremiah, you've been talking in the last few weeks even about how some of this Belt and Road Initiative has been written into the Chinese constitution, as Xi thought. So it's obviously, this is a big deal for China. So we're watching that unfold. But at the same time, the Bible is clear that this is not a great enduring friendship that's built on mutual trust and respect between these powers. It's one that's built on mutual self-interest. They both benefit from this trade. They're both going more and more suspicious of the United States, and they're banding together in opposition to the United States. It's not something that they just have deep and enduring interests. And so, yes, as you build that, then you would expect competition. You would expect friction. And then even Isaiah 23, it's not a China-led project with Europe playing a minor part in the description of this great mart of nations. They come across much more as equals. And really, China kind of owns the Belt and Road Initiative at the moment. So I would expect some friction as this takes its full form and as Europe kind of tries to get the place that it believes is due, not as a minor Chinese partner, but as a major player. So this is just a fascinating example of how you can watch Bible prophecy fulfilled right now. And as I said, it's just it's a wonderful way to prove Bible prophecy, because this is something that I said we started talking about just a year or two before this really exploded. And you can see tons of analysts talking about this now. There was no one back in 2010, 2011. And so I'd really encourage our listeners to go and read up on that. It's something we write on regularly in the Trumpet Print, and we'll include a couple of links from recent articles in the show notes so that you can take this opportunity just to watch Bible prophecy unfold.
Well, thanks very much for that, Richard. A federal court this week issued an edict saying the U.S. military must accept transgender service members within a very short time frame. And there are several different angles of this story that really make it significant and worrying. And to tell us about this, we'll go once again to Andrew Miller.
Right. This is just the latest step in like an ongoing drama that's been going on over this issue of should transgenders be allowed to serve in the military. For the first 227 years of America's constitutional history, every commander in chief decided that that would not help our military preparedness to have transgenders in the military. And then about 18 months before he left office, President Obama decided that would be a great idea and issued an executive order saying they were allowed to serve. We covered on this program in August that President Trump just reversed that order. But now we have, as of Monday, they had a federal judge who's ruled that not only can apparently President Trump not do that, but the military must start allowing transgenders in by January 1st, less than a month away.
Wow, coming up.
And even another judge saying that not only that, that the military is legally obligated to provide them like pay for the cost of the gender reassignment surgeries. Hmm. And so this is going to be something expensive for our military. Right. And one of the big concerning things is that it's really a judicial overreach into the president's powers as commander in chief. The Constitution gives the president the commander in chief role. Right. And then now you have just basically any of 1,700 judges can decide that his decisions as commander in chief aren't valid and overturn them apparently at whim. But I think the bigger story I'd like to focus on from a prophetic standpoint is just kind of how unstoppable this transgender movement has become. Even 10 years ago, you almost never heard, even 5 years ago, you almost never heard of things like this. And now it's just every week you've got something new. And I know there are some religious people who take a more biblical stance on issues like that who are excited about President Trump's executive order, which hasn't really done anything to hardly even slow down this thing for just a couple of months. Mm-hmm. But there is a quote here I brought from our editor-in-chief's book, Great Again, where he's just really emphasizing, Mr. Gerald Fleury, that America's problems are a direct result of America's sins. No politician is going to make America great again, no matter what people think. I would love to see it happen, but it isn't going to happen in this age. Everyone will come to recognize the truth before much longer. God will make America great again in the world tomorrow. He's going to solve our problems in spite of our rebellion. He will save America and the world at Jesus Christ's return, which will occur immediately after these climatic crises. Hmm. And so that's something that even one man trying to stand up against something like this doesn't do much good if the majority of the American people are in favor of something like this or of other sins that at least sap their will to fight against something like this.
Could you let the listeners know where they might go to get more information about this topic?
Right. To really get kind of like the full history of where this transgender movement came from, how it's been so successful, and what the Bible specifically says about things like gender roles, homosexuality, transgenderism, and their impact on families, and why it's important for every person in the nation. We have a book called Redefining Family by Mr. Joel Hilliker that we you can go online to the show notes and order it there, or call into our call center and order it there. But we'll send it directly to anyone who's curious about what the biblical stance on these issues are.
It's a very powerful booklet. So if anyone hasn't read that and is curious about just how rapidly the nation is transforming, I would highly recommend that booklet. Thanks a lot for that, Andrew. What Andrew just discussed there is a sobering indication of the state of the health of America as a whole, and also specifically of the U.S. military. And before we wrap up the show today, we have another story showing that the U.S. military is also in danger of losing out on another important front, artificial intelligence. And to tell us about this, we'll go once again to Kieran.
Thanks. Back in July, the Chinese government put out a report called Next Generation Artificial Intelligence Development Plan, a long title. But in that plan, they wanted to become equal with the U.S. in artificial intelligence by 2025. And then they wanted to become the world leader in artificial intelligence by 2030. And the question is, with that type of report, is whether that's just the Chinese telling us, talking big, or whether or not that's actually possible for them to do that. Now, a U.S. report has come out. This came out on Wednesday this week, confirming that China really is capable of doing what it said it would. This report was published by Robert Work and a partner of his, and it was published for the U.S. government. Work was the former Deputy Secretary of Defense. Here's a quote from this report. He says, "The U.S. must decide if it wants to lead the coming revolution or fall victim to it." He said that the U.S. is at risk of losing the AI race. Here's just one example that he included in his report. He talks about a research arm of the U.S. intelligence community who just wrapped up a competition to see who could develop the best facial recognition technology. This is just one part of their AI. The challenge was to identify as many passengers as possible walking onto an aircraft boarding ramp. This is the kind of thing that you would expect to see in movies like Minority Report or something, people being identified by their face. Anyhow, the people who won this entry was not a U.S. firm, but actually a Chinese startup company called Yitu Tech. They walked away with $25,000 of prize money for winning that. So here's just one final quote from the report. Robert Work says, "China is no longer in a position of technological inferiority relative to the United States, but rather has become a true competitor that may have the capability to overtake the United States in AI," which goes to show that their report back in July really was the real deal.
Wow. Yeah, that sounds like a really important trend for us to keep a close eye on. Could you put this in the context of Bible prophecy for us and just tell listeners where they might go to get more information on this topic?
Okay, well, I think you would have to look at this in the light of the Abrahamic blessings that were given to Britain, United States, starting in about 1800. And Andrew Miller in the first half really talked about this and described it pretty well. Those two countries were given these blessings, and they had technological power above all the rest of the world. Since about 1800 to about now, they have been the cream of the crop, and they were given that. They had the technological advantage. Now we're in a time which our editor-in-chief calls the times of the Gentiles, where really those advantages that America and Britain used to have, they don't have them anymore. They used to rule the seas. They used to rule the seas with aircraft carriers, the U.S. did. Now these look like they're obsolete. Other parts of their armies, especially AI and cyber technology, like we just talked about then, the times of the Gentiles have come and they don't have the advantage that they used to have. If any listener wants to get more information about this, for the best overview, I would just turn to Russia and China in Prophecy.
This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Please visit us there to read more about the stories that we're discussing today and to subscribe to our print edition and our news brief, which we send out several times each week. Tell us what you think about the program by emailing us at letters@thetrumpet.com. And thanks to our panel today, Andrew Miller, Brent Noctegal, Richard Palmer, and Kieran Underwood.
Good to be thanks. Here.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
And thanks also to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. And we'll leave you today with some lengthy but worthwhile words from the educator John Green. And he spoke these words in response to a hypothetical student asking that infamous question that students so often ask teachers, is this going to be on the test? Mr. Green said, yeah, about the test. The test will measure whether you're an informed, engaged, and productive citizen of the world. And it'll take place in schools and bars and hospitals and dorm rooms and in places of worship. You will be tested on first dates, in job interviews, while watching football, and while scrolling through your Twitter feed. The test will judge your ability to think about things other than celebrity marriages, whether you'll be easily persuaded by empty political rhetoric, and whether you'll be able to place your life in a broader context. The test will last your entire life, and it'll be comprised of the millions of decisions that, when taken together, will make your life yours, and everything, everything will be on it. So pay attention. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.